Hi, my name is Patricia Kathleen, and this podcast series will contain interviews I conduct with female and female-identified entrepreneurs, founders, co-founders, business owners, and industry gurus. These podcasts speak with women and women-identified individuals across all industries in order to shed light for those just getting into the entrepreneurial game, as well as those deep in the trenches. Histories current in companies and products and lessons learned are explored in the conversations I have with these insightful and talented powerhouses. This series is designed to investigate a female and female-identified perspective in what has largely been a male-dominated industry in the United States to date. I look forward to contributing to the national dialogue about the long overdue change of women in American business arenas, and in particular, in entrepreneurial roles. You can contact me via my website, patriciakathleen.com. Thank you for listening. Now let's start the conversation. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Patricia Kathleen, continuing my podcast series. Today, I am elated to be sitting down with a very old colleague of mine, Scotty Hill. A brief bio on Scotty. She is an art historian, critic, and attorney. After falling in love with art at the age of 4, she received her bachelor's and master's degrees in art history. She then taught art history at the University of Utah, Westminster College, and Utah Valley University for 4 years, while simultaneously curating, managing a commercial art gallery, and writing for the Deseret News, which is a newspaper in Utah, and 15 Bytes, which is Utah's art magazine. After getting into 2 PhD programs in art history, she decided to pivot and study law instead. The decision was in part the result of the exhibition she curated at the Topaz Museum, wherein she became fascinated with how the Constitution was used to strip American citizens of their civil liberties. She graduated from S.J. Quinney College of Law in 2018 and passed the bar in April this past year. Welcome, Scotty.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming. I didn't really give her a choice, but I'm so excited to talk with you because I know that a lot of our audience is, we were talking before the podcast started, but this concept about, redefining what your future is going to look like in the face of, a lot of people thinking that pivoting at certain points is maybe financially or career-wise suicide. And you're one of these stories, so I can't wait to get into it with you. I'm going to let Scotty unpack her entire story herself. A quick outline, like I always give you guys, going to be the same as other podcasts. We're going to first cover, we're going to talk about Scotty's educational and academic career, and then go from into some of her endeavors with art curation and writing, and then we will talk about law in the end, and we're going to wrap everything up with advice that Scotty has for all of you out there in the trenches, seasoned and novice alike. So let's jump right in. Let's start with your bachelor's and master's degrees.
Yes. So, I mean, maybe even a bit before that. As a child, I spoke in a different language than other kids, and that was an artistic language, drawing, and articulating my experience through the visual realm was kind of how I learned to communicate with others. Okay. And as I navigated throughout the, early and secondary education system, my parents were really great in kind of isolating opportunities for art instruction, art school, and that led me to this point when I was finishing high school of thinking, where does that leave me? What do I want to study? Right. Do I want to be an artist when I grow up?
Yeah.
And of course, society tells you, like, that's a really bad idea. You shouldn't be an artist. You're going to be a starving artist. So
I don't even hear it anymore. I don't hear children say, I want to be an artist. It's almost like a dying word.
It's true. And yeah. I hate that.
I do too.
It's sad. But of course, that is the beginning of the process of soul searching for how you can incorporate art into your career, mm-hmm. how you can provide for your family, how you can make a living, which right. are still very difficult questions that I continue to struggle with, yeah. which is why it's a great conversation to have.
Yeah.
So I decided art history would be much more lucrative,
right?
Which I kind of joke about, right? Because that in and of itself
is not lucrative.
It's not very lucrative, but
yeah.
But at least there's a methodology of saying, okay, I'm a historian of art. And so I did a bachelor's and a master's degree in art history at the University of Utah, worked very closely with some amazing professors who really nurtured that and thought that I was going to go on the academic track, kind of unquestioningly so, of tenure track professorship, just plow through.
Mm-hmm.
And I did all of that very quickly. And then I was 22 when I finished and got a master's degree. And then I was kind of realizing for the first time how difficult those tenure track jobs are to obtain. One professor told me it's like becoming a Hollywood actor,
mm-hmm.
Your chances of success. And whenever someone tells me that I can't do something or that it's going to be hard, it makes me want to do it more.
Yes.
And prove them wrong.
Yep.
But truly the realities of that did become apparent when I started to look at doctorate programs and looked at this, you know, terminal degree, which I find to be a very funny word for it, terminal, like,
right.
Terminal illness, terminal degree,
yeah,
which, you know, is kind of a sad thing that you spend, you know, 4 to 7 years of your life just working so hard and researching something valuable and important only to have very few opportunities at the end.
Mm-hmm. Even with the body of work, the thesis is rarely turned into, I mean, I think the goal is to turn it into a book, but so many people don't.
It's true.
You know, like, it seems tragic to me to spend that much time on something that you just end up being a professor, you know, in the
right.
end. It's tragic. Yeah, okay.
Well, it becomes more of a status symbol. Look at what I have done
mm-hmm.
based on the hoops that I've jumped through. Give me a job, and then mm-hmm. I start the whole process over again. I mean, this, I could easily get tangential about how I feel that there's so much wrong with
yeah,
that idea of how we don't value and appreciate that as a society as much.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I decided after graduate school, while I was deciding, you know, to pursue the PhDs, or the PhD singular, you know, what to do. And in the interim, I kind of forced a lot of really fun opportunities for myself,
mm-hmm.
which is becoming an art critic and basically trying to dive into
it. How did you get into those opportunities? Like, how did you introduce yourself to that? Because that didn't just land on you. You had to, like, hunt some things out, right?
It's true. It was a good lesson mm-hmm. in, you know, when you're young and impressionable and wanting to go into a field, you kind of assume that there are these pre-configured, highly established opportunities that exist and that people that embody those positions or you know, do that for a living, it's just about working hard enough and then you'll arrive there too.
Hmm.
What we don't place as much emphasis on is kind of forcing your way and creating opportunities on
yes.
your own.
Yeah.
And that's very much what happened with writing. We have an online art magazine here in Utah that's incredible, and I just asked them if I could write for them, and they said yes, and it's been a beautiful relationship
nice.
Ever since. But as far as the Deseret News is concerned, they're the second largest newspaper in Utah, owned and operated by the LDS Church.
Mm-hmm.
And one day I went up to the Museum of Fine Arts on campus, and they had this incredible blockbuster Latin American survey exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so impressive and so magnificent. And the Tribune, the kind of mainstay newspaper, had covered it, but the Deseret News was just crickets. And it made me mad.
Yeah.
It made me, you know, like, there's people that would love to see this, I think, but you're not letting your readers know.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent them an email, and I thought that I would get no response, but I sent them an email, you know, finely worded, and said, listen, I'm a concerned citizen, a you know, arts professional. I'm doing air quotes right now, but
yeah.
around the word professional.
Right.
But, you know, there's so much going on that you're just ignoring.
Yeah.
And that's not okay.
Good.
And I, you know, again, I thought it would be ignored, but they responded and they said, "You're right. We are dropping the ball, but we don't know how and we don't know what to do. So we'd love to have you come in and talk to us about a strategy for that, about how we can cover the arts." I mean, what they had been covering is like, you know, dance and theater, but, mm-hmm. but no visual arts. So I went into their office.
That makes me love them a little bit more. Like this, I love the, when corporate titans or however titan they are, you know, but these larger industries, when they reach back in and acknowledge flaw, I think it's just it's paramount, especially when it's customer service based, you know, it's customer oriented based. I love that they reached back out and said, let's start some dialogue over it.
It's great. It's the best case scenario, but I suppose the point is that you never know until you try.
Yes. You reached out with that email.
Right.
And so many of us say, it's horrible. I wish it would change. And that's that, you know, finely worded email, as you said, sent to the right place at the right time, and they're meeting up with you. So what came from that meeting?
So I sat down with their associates at section, their associates editor, features editor, excuse me, that they have, you know, less and less editors and columns because of the nature of the journalism industry as it exists, and they have largely switched to a community-based contribution model online,
mm-hmm.
where they're recruiting, you know, anyone to sort of write their articles for them, and in order to downsize. But they do have, you know, a features section, and I sat down with them, and they said, you know, due to the cuts, due to the downsizing, we have some blind spots. And you sound like you know what you're talking about and what we should cover and what's happening, so why don't you lead the charge? Which is not what I was expecting when I went in there, but I thought,
it's
sure.
It's a job. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
That's great.
It was wonderful. And I still write for them maybe once or twice a month, which is about all I can do,
mm-hmm.
with my busy schedule. But it's a great opportunity. And in the past few years, I've seen them really go from being kind of in this, you know, ignorant, helpless sort of mindset of we need all the help we can get, we don't know what's going on, to having now 3 editors later, someone who's really passionate and actually pitching me stories and showing up and getting press releases and actually representing,
perfect.
You know, what's going on in the visual arts scene in Utah, which is great.
I love that. I love the expansive, the inclusive dialogue with everyone. You know, I think that it's getting a little bit polar, even our country, you know, getting, not to diatribe, but like the politics, you know, the divisiveness, I'm over it. The inclusive dialogue is the only way we're going to move forward as a species, you know? And so I really believe that including it in this being mirrored on even a microscopic level, you know, by the Deseret News in this manner of, we weren't covering the arts, let's do it. And now growing into this kind of inclusive dialogue, like it's only going to help all of the readers and everyone else stay inclusive in their own lives with the arts.
Definitely.
So you created that opportunity for yourself. What about the curation opportunities? Like when did those come about with, because I know you've curated several different exhibits and things like that. Did you seek those out? Did they come to you?
Yes, that's a great question. And a lot of young people who study art history and are similarly unsure if they want to, you know, just be a professor or do the PhD at the end of it, that seems to be kind of the one track. But I have been contacted by a few folks who are like, you know, maybe there are other opportunities. And curating is very similar in terms of just kind of forcing those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I have developed a few really meaningful relationships with people who own galleries and, you know, commercial art spaces, nonprofit art spaces. And I think really what I can distill it down to is just showing up and being a part of an artistic community.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not as if everything is very clear. Again, things are very clearly defined, and it's just about you know, getting that job or, you know, applying to something. It's like, you know, maybe you just curate a show of artists that you know and rent a space.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it
create it. Yeah.
Yeah, you create it. And that's kind of what I did for a few of the shows that I curated. And then, of course, the one that was the most meaningful, definitely for me, was the Topaz Museum. And I came about that through, again, through a connection. So I think that's just so much of how opportunities.
Did you show interest? I think so too. I really believe that over 90% of at least the most important opportunities in my life came from my expressing interest or meeting up with someone, or like you're saying, actually just saying, this is the job I want. I just created it. You do it with me. You know, yeah, that kind of yeah. a thing. But so did you reach out to the Topaz people? How did that all come together?
Yes. So the museum hadn't even opened yet. So it was the brainchild, or is the brainchild, of this remarkable woman named Jane Beckwith, who was a school teacher, a high school teacher in Delta, Utah. Was very interested and sort of devoted her life to documenting the history and preserving the memory of the Topaz internment camp, which housed over 8,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. Mm-hmm. And her life's goal was to create a museum in honor of this. And she did. But the first order of business was to mine the art collection. This museum actually had an art collection of people who were interned there during the war, mm-hmm. and to showcase it and to do a show of the work that they created at an art school that they had built there.
Yeah.
So I knew a man, I still know him, but at the time, Frank McIntyre, who's an artist and a former writer for the Salt Lake Tribune, was asked to curate the show, and he couldn't. And so he passed my name along. And I had never done anything on that scale before. It was a kind of the limelight of having a lot of press interested in it and a lot of people wanting to show up. And it was incredible. It was a great experience.
When the idea got slid to you, was your first impulse to back down or to charge? And it was clearly a very huge prospect, you know, and it was, like you said, the scale and scope was 10 times what you were used to doing. What was your first initial response to it?
Oh, I was so excited. Let's do this.
I love it.
Although, you know, when you hear, oh, it's the art made by folks who are in the camp, mm-hmm. you don't really know what to expect by that.
No, I think hearing it now, and I never went to the exhibit, but I didn't have the opportunity to make that clear because it sounds fascinating. I mean, the entire concept is just riveting for me. You know, I love exhibits that get into those microclimates. You know, mm-hmm. studying the Japanese internment camps was something that I did in school as well for my thesis. And the idea of art being produced there, of course it was. And I've never even really entertained that kind of concept of the folklore and the culture that kind of took place in those microclimates of the internment, you know, camps and things like that. So what did you find when you found, I wouldn't even know what to expect. Is it documents? Is it visual arts? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you would have just equally been amazed and blown away because, you know, I wasn't sure if this was just student art, you know, again, what to expect. But once I looked at the collection, I was floored by the incredible talent. And it was professional artists, in fact.
Yeah.
Chira Obata was the founder of the Topaz Art School, and he was a very well-renowned painter in Japan who then immigrated to America, and it was his brainchild. He started at one of the temporary internment camps in California and then brought it to Topaz, and there were a couple of world-class artists who taught and who contributed art, and we have it in this collection. And then, of course, some student work. And so I was just so amazed, and my expectations were just surpassed when I saw the
artwork. Did you have a mentor you leaned on? Because you're jumping into a project of such magnitude and you hadn't kind of built a scalable, you know, model before that, did you take advice or did you reach out to anybody, or did you just like bootstrap Yankee know-how, I'm just going to figure this one out?
Yeah, so that's a good question, because I felt very strongly that my art historical training up until that point had served me well, which is, you know, interpreting the meaning of this art, curating, you know, there was a bit of politics involved in it because I wanted to select works on paper and use that as a great opportunity to showcase the variety of different techniques and varied, you know, experimental opportunities that come within this one specific medium. And the museum said, we just want all of it in there. We want the oil paintings. We want, you know, everything.
Right.
But they were just works on paper. And I fought hard for that. And I think it ended up really well, displaying very well. And the message came across well. But, of course, we had someone who assisted me in actually designing the exhibition. I couldn't do that alone. I'm not very good with a nail and hammer.
Right.
And I had a basic idea of the groupings I wanted and the big picture. And I wrote all of the labels and the theme and did an enormous amount of research. But it was daunting. And I did have, you know, to lean on the museum for factual information. As a white privileged woman, I also was very careful and cognizant about not wanting to tell anyone else's very, very personal stories.
Mm-hmm. There's two levels of politics. I mean, you have the political realm that, or the politics involved in just curation in general that outsigns everything, and then the exhibit itself was political. Like,
yes.
There's so many levels that you're kind of dancing around. It's a daunting for me a idea to curate something like that, because it just the amount of intelligence that it takes to kind of really consider every angle is amazing. So you were cognizant of all of that while undergoing not just communications, but the design and, like you're saying, communicating these stories.
Yes.
Did you find a good rhythm with that, or did you take, you just kind of followed your own intuition?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of constructing the exhibition, putting all the artwork in place, big picture, you know, tactical things, we had an exhibition designer who did all of that.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, the other thing I think I struggled with was wanting to use this as an opportunity to educate people about traditional Japanese art making practices such as sumi-e ink drawing,
mm-hmm.
And things like that, while also not treating the Japanese culture as a monolith. And saying, this is Japanese art, guys, take
right.
a look.
Yeah, exactly. That's the
right.
kind of minutiae I'm talking about.
Yeah.
yeah. Minefields.
Yeah, but it was, but you know, I think everybody deserves an opportunity to be challenged and then to impress yourself with how you stepped up to the plate. I spent a lot of time on it, and I really do still consider it one of the most meaningful things that I've done. And again, it played a role in me wanting to study law, because
mm-hmm.
it came at this pivotal time in our country where this episode, this stain really on American history, had the capability of repeating itself.
Mm-hmm.
It still does in my
yeah.
mind. And so I think when you give something everything you have and really work as hard as you possibly can, it may sound cliche, but I think that shows in the final result.
Yes.
The care and the attention and the effort that you put into something will show. And I hope that that's what I was able to do with this show.
I'm sure it was. And what you take as a human being from it. You know, I always tell people that hard work is constantly rewarding itself. It's doing it. It's showing yourself, you know, how limitless we really are, particularly as women who have been given a lot of boundaries and ceilings and limits, you know, to really expand your awareness. I always think that I'm a titan, you know, but I'm constantly reproving how titan I am to myself. And that's in and of itself, you know, it's its own reward. It keeps paying off in the moment and afterwards, like what you took away from that exhibit about who you are as an academic, as an entrepreneur, as a woman, you know, in this society is amazing. I mean, every question you had to put before yourself, your white privilege that you mentioned, all of these different things, like really re-examining those things are in and of themselves a reward, you
yes.
know, and you grow so much from them that I think that it's just exponential. I don't think that's ever explored enough. And it ties really well into you, this very incredibly brave choice you made to pivot away from, I mean, you're still heavily involved in art history, but can you speak to like what decision process went behind you kind of reaching away from the PhD track and pivoting into law?
Yes, thank you for that transition, because it's, I mean, I got so many questions when I started law school from my professors and classmates of like, why are you here? What is the connection between art and law? That's so odd, you know. I mean,
it's you. You're the connection.
Here I am, guys.
Yeah.
And then now, you know, these folks who become like family when you go through, you know, three mm-hmm. years of hellish law school together, they'll
yes.
send me these, you know, art law related articles all the time, and like, you know, they kind of took an opportunity to see the connection as well, which is fun. But in a nutshell, and I related to, you know, the pivoting and the reinvention that I heard on some other episodes of this podcast,
mm-hmm.
and the idea of, you know, it is very scary and frustrating, and once I realized that a PhD in art history was not really what I wanted, there wasn't enough security, there wasn't enough, I mean, it's just, again, all the things we talked about, so much work for maybe less certainty at the end of it. And so I then looked at careers or professions that would take or would utilize analogous skills that I had already been doing. And I ended up talking to a lot of law school folks about this too. In art history, you read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly analyzing text.
Yeah.
You're forging connections between what you're seeing and interpreting and arguing. Close reading and inspection is rewarded in a scholarly discipline. And I saw that as a similar skill set in the law. And so I took the LSAT, went to law school, and I was a fish out of water for sure. As much as I was trying to tell
yeah.
people, like, here's the connection, it makes sense. It was completely new.
Mm-hmm.
And I struggled a lot my first year. Just, did I make the right decision? I wanted to quit. Like, is this really for me?
Yeah.
But the more I got into it, the more I realized that it's such a great way of actually making an impact in the world. Knowing about the law, in my opinion, shouldn't be as difficult as it is for the average person to understand. But going through law school is an incredible door-opening process of seeing the connections between
mm-hmm.
the law and so many infinite facets of our world.
Mm-hmm.
And I eventually decided to just calm down, finish law school. And again, I really loved learning about constitutional law, immigration law, to go through law school during the presidential chaos of 2016 was fascinating, and I think I'll look back on that in 30 years and say, wow.
Yeah.
What a time.
Interesting pairing.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I feel personally, and I have always felt, that there is a poetry to law. I truly believe that studying the law is, for me, when I've looked at it, more philosophy than practice-based. I feel like practicing law becomes trade, like a trade school basis, but actually knowing it is more of a poetry or a philosophy. You know, it's built, even the way that a lot of the law, old law, is constructed, you know, reaching back into the Constitution and things like that, it has a philosophical tone to it, which I think was designed to, you know. It also has an exclusive tone to it, which was because it was white privileged men writing that,
yes.
you know, and that should be analyzed in and amongst itself. But looking at the law, for me, is an exercise more in art than it is in some, you know, practical trade-like. So making that connection, I think, is more difficult than art history and law school. Those things go together. It's becoming a lawyer and law school that don't make sense to me.
Yes. No,
you know, the actual practicing.
Yes.
So it's cool to hear you talk about that and the links up to it. What after, so you finished law school and then you have the bar, you study for the bar, right? How long did that take? Like, how long does it take to study for the bar?
You know, everyone...
Does it vary?
It varies. And, you know, I had folks who were studying, who were like a year ahead of me while I was still finishing law school, and they said, you know, this is going to be the worst time of your life. It's so awful. And again, I shrugged it off like, yeah, yeah. What they recommend is that you, once you graduate, you know, you graduate in May and then you take the bar in late July. So you have a couple of months of intense studying and turnaround, and they really advise that you treat that like a full-time job.
Yeah.
And so I had done that last year from May to July. I took the bar last July, and I didn't pass by 4 multiple choice questions.
Oh.
So it was painfully close.
It's heartbreaking.
Horrible,
yeah.
Horrible.
And they're multiple
thing.
Choice. Like, how close was I?
Oh,
was it
gosh.
A or B? You know,
right.
Like, was it your second choice that you didn't get?
I'll never
that's
know.
Insane. I know. So that's, and I was telling Scotty off the record that we didn't have to get into this, but one of my favorite just pre-meeting conversations about this, points of our conversation before beginning the podcast is, I love hearing trial and error moments from people as smart as you, because Scotty is by far one of the most intelligent people I have ever met. And when people of her caliber fall, it's awesome. We should share those experiences more. You know, I think it unites us much more than building a startup that becomes a unicorn within a year. You know,
yes.
Those are too far between, like those are outliers. Like we are all right here, you know, taking the bar and not passing it. I want to know this. My understanding from the outside, studying for the LSAT is supposed to be like this 2-month endeavor as well. So is it the same difficulty, or do you think the bar is functioning on a different level of, because we have all these tests, right? The GRE. The MCAT, the LSAT, like all of these, and then afterwards the bar, the examiner, all these different board certifications, surgeons or doctors, MDs have all of these different things that they do. Do you think that it's not set up to actually help? Like if you didn't pass it, I don't think anybody can, you know, the first go around. Like, do you know what you missed from doing that? Like, did you take stock in what you'd done with missing the bar or no?
Yes. I love this, by the way. I mean, not passing the bar.
Your hair.
Oh, sure.
There we go. Sorry. I'm
that's
adjusting that mic for you.
not passing the bar was immensely disappointing, to say the least, as you can imagine. But I love this conversation for a couple of reasons. One, because I have a lot of problems with the way that society primes individuals to succeed or fail. I mean, again, with the bar, it's either a pass or fail. So when you say I failed, and how many times you have to repeat that, I failed the bar, I failed the bar, that unconsciously sends this message as you repeat that word over and over and over again of I failed. And I take issue with that. And there's actually there's the podcast Revisionist History by Malcolm Gladwell. In this new season that just began, in the course of 2 episodes, he decides to take the LSAT with his assistant, who's much younger.
Nice.
And kind of makes very eloquently a lot of the points that I've talked to people about, which is the timing, the idea of a standardized test as a complete measure of one's capability.
I think it's sadistic. Standardized tests are, it doesn't even speak to us as who we, as human beings.
We're so
individual. It's crazy to base our accomplishments in academia based on standardized tests. I think it's so silly, but that's another time. Go on.
No, it's true. And so when I didn't, I think that there maybe perhaps is a difference between when you transition from a field where you can spend time elaborating on ideas and letting them marinate and articulating them over the course of a book or a thesis. I mean, really fleshing things out. And then having to go into law school and taking a 3-hour exam and having your fingers stiff because you're typing to the very last second. And the cramming nature of law school was so foreign to me, which I think is what made the transition tough. And with the bar, I felt very confident about it. Like, you know, I know the law. This is good. I'm fine.
Yeah.
And I looked back and I looked at my old exam. I got a tutor so that I could revamp my study methods. Like, what needs to be done? I don't think it's a substantive issue. I don't think that I don't get it.
Right.
I think I'm not good at playing the game that needs to be played.
Yeah.
Clearly. And
I mean, I think that's an awesome way to look at it too, just to be able to say, you know, it's reclaiming some power from that, like, I failed. I didn't pass the bar. Like, no, the bar didn't pass me. So we need to get back together. You know, that kind of like, let's figure out what happened there. You didn't fail. You weren't thinking in the bar method, you know? And
it's
so
right.
It's like reanalyzing that and coming back at it is, it's a very legal, right?
It's very legal,
Reexamining
yes.
that relationship is like in and of itself very, based on law and things like that. So you reexamined it, you went back in, and was the second time you took it, was there, tell me about anxiety on a personal level. Were you ready to like show the bar who was boss, or were you kind of nervous again, or were you ready for it? Like, did you feel confident or scared?
I was nervous about it.
Okay.
I mean, I wish I could say I was totally ready. I was gonna, make it my own. What I had done the second time was memorize the law verbatim, which is an exhaustive amount of law to try to memorize, but I would, record myself and recite the elements of the law, listen to it on my way to work, study it, write it out every day. And truth be told, I feel a little upset that that's what it has to be. And I passed handily the second time. But I was nervous. To me, that kind of highlights a larger flaw that I have with the legal educational system, that's what it took to pass was just to be a recording, regurgitating machine. And I don't think there's enough support for people that don't learn that way. I don't think there's people in law school that sit you down and say, here's what happens when you don't pass the bar the first time. It's like a silent culture of shame. I had this woman who...
My word, yeah, it is. I agree.
It truly is. This woman, whose husband is a lawyer, she came up to me and kind of said, very, very surprisingly, she's like, it's just like abortion. So many people experience it, but no one wants to talk about it. And I thought, oh, that's
a really
an
good
intense analogy.
Yeah, it is.
But it's true. I mean, there's kind of a culture of shame, and I would really take law school... the legal education system to task for that. Looking back, I can say that, I want to talk to more people about it. I want there to be resources for people that don't pass to say, okay, what does this mean?
Yeah, I don't know that I need a lawyer that can just regurgitate things as well. Like,
well,
I want a petition for a different kind. I'd like a more thoughtful person. That's just multiplication. 5 times 5, 25.
Right.
Like, there's nothing behind that. I memorized that when I was 8.
Yeah.
It's like they're... To actually, be more concise, well, what 5 things are you talking about? Or, that kind of a thoughtful person, I'd rather have that than someone who's just pushing those memorized tidbits back onto paper.
Well, of course, that's the biggest criticism of the bar exam as a metric, which is that in the real world, as a lawyer, you will have deadlines. Your boss says, write this pleading for me by the end of the day. It's 5 o'clock on a Friday, and you're like, damn it. I was going to leave, so of course that happens, but never in the legal world are you going to say, okay, the judge needs your, multiple choice answers in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, that timing, lawyers have time to pontificate, to research, to spread out.
Yes.
That's just how the world works. So
yeah,
it's not really ever as intense as that.
What's your niche? Did you find a niche in law school or afterwards? And where are you right now with it? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So happy to say that is a work in progress.
Oh, cool.
I've always been very politically active and very much into, social justice, I suppose. And so I was immediately attracted to, again, constitutional law, immigration law. My goal is to really improve my Spanish so that I can, can dive into that. I took a Spanish for Lawyers course in law school, which was tough, but my Spanish isn't quite up to par, but I would love to do pro bono cases on an immigration
we need it.
Level.
Yes.
That's so badly needed, of course, right now. But for much of law school, I was devoted to the idea of art law, of seeing if that was actually a thing and an area where lawyers could work. And I worked in New York City for 2 summers and worked for this great organization called the Center for Art Law.
Nice.
And we worked on some incredible projects. There's in New York specifically, there's still, surprisingly maybe, a lot of repatriation cases. Because of the large refugee and immigrant population in New York City.
Yeah.
I got to work with a 91-year-old relative of a Holocaust survivor who wanted to reclaim a work that was taken while his family was taken to the death camps.
Mm-hmm.
And there are still cases where people are trying to get that art back to give to their grandchildren.
I can't believe there are still, if you'd asked, I would never have imagined.
Yeah.
So that company, or sorry, the foundation is taking on those cases, and you got to experience that firsthand.
Yes.
That's amazing.
It was fascinating.
Is that the only kind of company of its kind, or are there more frequent, like, I don't even know how many art versus law or art meets law kind of firms there are?
Right. So I was kind of exploring that and seeing if that was a viable, you know, area to pursue. And art law is sort of a melting pot of all sorts of different types of legal areas, right? So
right.
The real estate attorneys can be very helpful for artists and their studios, and particularly in really densely populated cities like New York City, navigating the tax structure of having a home studio, for example, and helping artists out in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, intellectual property is a huge one for art law because of helping artists register their copyrights and branding their business.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all sorts of different areas of the law that kind of pool together to become art law. And in New York City and LA, I mean, coastally, those are really the places where that flourishes. But even in those big cities, lawyers who would consider themselves art lawyers are a relatively small and tight-knit group of attorneys. Although there are firms that do specialize in art law because of how many artists there are. And there is a national network called the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts. And each state, because Utah's is now defunct. But
tragic.
I know. But a lot of states have a volunteer attorneys for the arts network where attorneys will volunteer their time to help out artists with the issues that they may face. And there are a lot that emerge. And I think it's kind of an overlooked area.
Yeah, it is. So do you think that you're going to carve some of that out? Or how are you going to continue surveying it? Are you going to switch it up? Or, I mean, how are you now forecasting the next 3 years? Like, how are you going to give yourself a good dose of knowing what you want to do?
That's a great question. Right now I work in real estate law. So
okay.
That's been very informative and interesting. I think eventually I really would like to pivot again and dive more into art law. We have some promising things on the horizon here, an arts and entertainment law chapter of the Utah State Bar that recently formed.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully we can start to generate some interest in that and expand. But in the meantime, you know, helping artists protect themselves is a really easy and valuable thing that an attorney can do, because registering mm-hmm. copyrights and trademarks is like, you know, it's a very quick and not as difficult process as one might think, and it's completely invaluable to really protecting yourself. Now, artists in Utah have all sorts of other problems, which is that, you know, they have full-time jobs that aren't art related.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is, you know, admittedly a difficult thing to do in a non-coastal area.
Hmm.
So if I figure out something novel on that front, I'll be sure to report back.
But yeah, meantime, for sure. Well, and as someone reach out to Scotty, I feel like this, you're going to define this and change this. I see this for you. It's
Thank
happening.
You. Thank you. I hope so.
So if someone was, if you were going to advise someone just starting out, let's take someone just coming out of their bachelor's degree. And let's say this person is of two different minds to study, to continue studying or do something else. What kind of advice would you give someone who is looking at either continuing with a graduate degree or working in the occupation? Like, given that you have this past history with doing both and pivoting and doing things like that, what's the best thing someone who's kind of a divided mind or looking at but doing a bunch of things could start out doing?
That's an amazing question. And I, you know, I've been asked before, if I knew what I know now, would I still mm-hmm. do 2 degrees in art history? And unequivocally, yes. I think, you know, there's a couple of undergraduate students who I have talked to specifically about this question. And they very desperately want to get master's degrees in art history because you kind of get on this momentum. Mm-hmm. And you know, because you love art history and have a master's degree in art history, which is like, I mean, that's the most fun I've ever had in my whole life.
Oh, yeah. It was a joy. It was. It was some of the best 3 years, you know. It was great. But I had no intention of doing anything with it. When people would say, what are you going to do with it? And I said, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
I'm getting the degree. That's getting the degree was its reward. You know, I wasn't planning on making anything with it. I thought it would just come into play as it did.
Well, so. I love that. And I think it actually brings up a really fascinating point because we get absolutely stuck and frozen in that mindset of everything that I'm doing has to be a stepping stone or a ladder piece to go up or, you know, move somewhere. And I love what you're saying about I'm doing it. But I think, you know, it's so deeply ingrained in our culture, like the uncle at Thanksgiving that's like, well, what are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
How are you going to make money doing
so
that?
True.
You know, and it's like you're programmed from birth to think of it that way. And in a way you can understand because millennials are facing this existential crisis right now. I mean, the media infantilizes them and treats them as cutesy for having side hustles.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're writing and working 3 jobs because they're feeling anxiety about being able to have a house and have financial stability. That's not fun. That's scary. That's intimidating. If you don't have, you know, wealth generationally, especially, that's a lot to handle. And so on the one hand, you can understand this push to say, listen, maybe the skill set that you took from art history could translate into something more lucrative. That's exactly what I did. Exactly what I tried to do is like, you know,
myself
pivot.
As well.
Yeah, and it's almost like a necessary thing nowadays. I wish and hope that we could get to this point where we could appreciate the art of learning about the humanities and the arts for its own sake.
Yes. Well,
as
learning
valuable.
For its own sake in general.
Yeah.
All of academia. There is not one person. It's called trade school. Those are the people that actually practice what they went to school for.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else is studying the life of the mind on some level, be it arts, science, anything. You know, you're not taking directly what you learned. And okay, let's say 98% of the time, you're not taking directly what you learned and implementing it. You are serving as a conduit for how you're going to use that later. You are the translator between what you're learning and how you're implementing it. And once we accept that, the universities can return to the ivory tower that they were always meant to be, a place where you went just to experience how to think and cultivate the life of thinking, the mind, you know? And so I'm a huge advocate of that as well. And I truly believe that that's what we do with information and survey. I hate the idea that, you know, people are, we push it on success, getting back to kind of what you were saying. I agree, everyone, you know, and I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs, you have to have a game plan. It's a good idea. But getting to that anxiety level about needing to know where every single piece fits, it leaves no room left open for what we actually reward, which is true genius. And that comes from creativeness. That comes from thinking outside. This country was spawned and climbed up to the top of, you know, the world spectrum by being creative and by being wild and rebellious and brave, you know, and those all come from not following a generated game plan. You want to have an idea of where you're headed. Don't get me wrong. Take some water bottles, but like, you know, you also have to have this kind of like, I'm going to implement it as I go. You know, you have to leave room for this kind of like, I'm not quite sure yet element of that type of a thing, which you've so perfectly done with your history. I love that.
Well, thank you. And I really appreciate what you're saying. This is kind of in the air right now, and I've had a few conversations about this. And just like one point to kind of tie this together that I would make is that there are facets of our society that are invaluable and just immensely rewarding that don't have a very easy or direct correlation with sheer economic viability. In other words, we should be at a point in our government, in our society, in our collective consciousness, where we're funding things because they are just valuable. An example quickly of this is the Stanford University Press, which I believe it was either this year or last, was, you know, there was an announcement that they were going to get rid of it because it wasn't economically viable, which isn't the role of a university press per se, right? It's about the dissemination of ideas and research. And so I think this higher education and larger societal push to distill everything down to its most useful and economically viable output is actually kind of a dangerous trend when we need to preserve some facets of our society that are just useful and worth investing in because they enrich us.
Right. This is where I feel like Elon Musk would really agree with us, because there is, everyone who's afraid of robots taking over the world needs to get behind the arts, because that's the only thing that, you know, machines are never going to be able to do like a human being. So I agree. And I mean, it's a weird parallel to draw into it, but I think it's crucial. And I agree with what you're saying about the economic value, distilling everything into like, what is, you know, that dollar amount worth, even it's a dangerous train to follow. And I do it accidentally myself all of the time.
Well, it's how we're programmed robotically even, right? Because we have to survive.
Yeah.
But then somehow that kind of gets to our psyche in terms of the meaning. I mean, you can look at someone who is very accomplished, but if they don't make a lot of money, you know, somehow their respectability is questioned. So I think it's something we should really be careful about and look at and not kind of let that slide.
I agree. So if you were advising someone, you would encourage them not to have to be so anxiously looking at every single step, right? Your takeaway from that is that you would encourage them to do what?
Yes, and I'm realizing now I didn't fully answer that question, but yes, saying, you know, if you want to engage in that exercise of saying, what does a degree in the humanities get me? You can say, great public speaking, great articulation of ideas, comfort with speaking to people and explaining yourself and navigating through difficult situations. I mean, you know, having to explain contemporary art to people and doing it well,
right?
Man, that's a skill.
Yeah.
And so you can say, I'm doing this because I want to do it, because it's amazing, while also being comforted by the fact that there are really tangible skills that you're taking from that if you want to pivot, which you probably will have to do, because we all should, even if we don't absolutely have to. So I would say continue with your humanities degree, invest in yourself, because that might be the best time of your life.
Yeah.
You know, and then have a little bit of faith in yourself and don't listen to your uncle at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, right. Tell him, evolve or die, man. Evolve or die.
Exactly.
Darwin had us all right.
Yes.
Okay, so looking back over the last, with you, I think I want to say 5 to 7 years. So we're going back, including law school and back into just after art history, master's was obtained. What are the three things that you are so glad, they can be broad or microscopic, that you did, that you would never change, and they could be good or bad? So no value assigned either way, just what are the three things that either happened or that you chose to do that you're so glad happened?
I love that. I think, I mean, when I was a kid, I used to be painfully shy. And then as I got older, I realized that that wasn't going to serve me well. And then at a certain point, I forced myself to interact with people, probably in my early 20s. And then I had this amazing realization that nobody knows what in the hell they're doing, and we're all just existing day by day, and nobody is thinking as much about you as you're thinking about yourself.
Yes.
And so I learned, I think, a really important lesson about just showing up. And supporting other people who are doing things that you would want to be supported in doing, whether it's an exhibition of someone's artwork, writing about an issue that you believe in, even if no one's going to read it, forcing opportunities, again, for yourself because you know that it's a valuable thing to do. And then, so that might be one and two. But the third is failure. It's so important.
It is. I'm
It's
so glad you
really
said
important.
that.
Yes.
Everyone always goes with the positive. And I love that too. I love looking at the positive. But some of the best things that have ever happened to me were not my happiest days,
Yeah.
because they really shaped. It's how we rise from that fall, always.
Yeah.
And you can't rise from anything if you don't fall.
It's true, and I think that when I get very stressed, like I've got this task that's coming up, how am I going to complete it? I don't have enough time. You have this mini internal archive, I think, over time that you build up of saying, okay, I've been in this situation so many times before, and I've gotten it done. And that those little tiny instances compile to form an armor that you wear where you say, I've got this. And when you fail, I mean the struggle for me in failing the bar was maybe I don't have what it takes. Maybe this is the universe trying to tell me something. And once you start reading into what everyone else is doing and comparing yourself to other people and so many other people passed and I failed. That's a really dangerous game. And I'm not going to pretend like it wasn't very, very hard. But it's great when you have an opportunity to reinvent yourself, to impress yourself, and to do something that you didn't think you could do.
I mean, I feel like it's made you a more powerful. I don't pray for anyone's struggle or anything like that, but I don't even know if you're aware of how you're looking at the law right now. That has probably evolved with this whole bar saga of yours,
Oh,
and
yeah.
your openness to being, involved in difficult scenarios now has probably evolved and changed, even just within the industry of the law,
I feel like I know the law better than a lot of attorneys because it's still so, because I've memorized it and it's tattooed in the back of my brain.
That's
Yeah, it's
right.
true.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I always end with asking, well, not always, in the past couple of months, I have ended with asking everyone, my final, it's like inside the actor's studio, but it's my version of it. So, what is the best thing that you're going to do today? What are you most excited to do today?
Ooh. Well, aside from spending a lovely afternoon with my dog, who is just my soulmate, I'm going to get back to writing and I'm going to write an article for the Deseret News about a strong, incredible female leader who has now taken over the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. And I'm excited to dive into what her plans are with the museum and tell people what good things contemporary art can do for society and kind of wrapping up a lot of the things that we talked about today. But I just feel so lucky that I get to write an article like that and share that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, thank you so much. We're gonna wrap up. I'm so grateful. I know you're the busiest person in the world, and I'm so happy that you took a Saturday gorgeous afternoon in the summertime in Salt Lake City, Utah, to sit down and like share your story with me and everyone out there. I really
Well,
appreciate
thank
it.
you so much for taking an interest. I
Yes,
appreciate
of
it.
course. Thank you for listening, everyone, and remember to always bet on yourself. Sláinte.